It's really one book, but it's divided into two in your Bible, 1 and 2 Samuel, which is in the Old Testament. But I wanted to give a quick report on last week. You guys had a great service. I was not here. I was up in New York State near Rochester with my dad, who's also not here. He's in South Carolina visiting my older brother. And it was really, he invited me to go. And I, you know, I'm kind of at this point in my life where if my dad asked me to do something with him, I'm going to do it. There was a period in my life where I was like trying to, I want to be my own man and, you know, not be known as Michael Cotton's son, because in the circle of churches I was in growing up, he was sort of a hero, you know, and still is. Most of you guys just don't know him that way. But in my world, everybody was like, you're Michael Cotton's son, you know, wow. And I was like, I'm my own man, you know, and I outgrew that fairly quickly, and now it's just a lot of fun to be able to go with him. And he's had a it's kind of an oversight relationship with several churches up there for a lot of years, and they invited him to come and do kind of his annual, or you know, trip up there where he ministers to everybody and does his prophetic thing. And I went up with him, and it was just a really great time. It's a really cool church. Met some cool people, was as encouraging as I could be, and then came home. And it was, you know, it's one of those things where when you go away from home, it makes you appreciate home more. It's not a comment about the church there, all right? It's just not home, right? And I love doing that sort of thing, but I get really homesick really fast. I'm homesick by the time the plane gets to 34,000 feet. And so it's really great to be here. And it's just, I heard you parents on the panel last week did a fantastic job. Clap. It's good. You guys are really open, which I was hoping for, but not open in an awkward way. Just open, right? Really honest. It's really cool. So let's get into, we're going to get into 1 Samuel this morning. And let me give you a little quick background to this book. It's in the middle of several history books. And the whole thing, the overall kind of theme or narrative of 1 and 2 Samuel is that up until this moment in history in Israel, Israel didn't have a king. There was no monarchy. It was a theocracy, a very pure theocracy. And there were people called judges that God would appoint at various times to just sort of say what God was saying and to lead the people and to mediate disputes and that sort of thing. But they didn't have a ruler. It was just God speaking to the people as directly as he typically does through one or two people, and they were called judges. And so imagine a culture like that. It's hard for us, where there's not kind of one person in charge of the whole thing. There's this guy and this guy, and God just kind of does his thing, and you're sort of led by God. And that's how the culture works. That's how your government works. Imagine that. But that's hard for us because we live in the age of separation of church and state, which I don't think is a bad thing, right? But that's how this culture works, right? Samuel, the prophet, comes along, right? And he kind of makes the transition between that system of government and leadership to a monarchy, which is still supposedly being led by God, right? But some of those kings are not very righteous and some are. And you get that new system come in, right? And we're going to see that transition that Samuel makes from no king to Saul and then ultimately to David, right? So we'll see those stories. And the story starts not with the king, which I think is pretty cool, but it starts with the prophet, the last judge of Israel, who is going to be Samuel. And you know this story maybe vaguely about Hannah, who couldn't have children and eventually has Samuel. Okay, so that's the story we're going to look at this morning. 1 Samuel chapter 1, starting in verse 1. We'll do the first 8 verses to start with. And you're going to get introduced to a lot of characters at once. And I'll try to help you remember all these people, all right? Verse 1, it says, there was a certain man of Ramathaim Sophim of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, all right? Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephrathite. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. All right, so now we have the main characters, Elkanah, the husband, and he has two wives, Hannah and Peninnah, right? Peninnah had children, Hannah had no children, all right? Now, in the Old Testament, in those times, it was most common for a man to have one wife, but it happened. But when they had more than one wife, usually it was either for political reasons, you see that with David and Saul, and sometimes it was because the first wife couldn't have children, and so the man would go marry another woman so that they could have children. Kind of messed up, right? And what we're going to see here as we think about Hannah and her situation, it sort of gets pretty dark for her. If you just understand a little bit of the culture behind the scenes here, her life is pretty dark and pretty terrible. Okay, and we're going to get into that and see what God does with it. So imagine, ladies, for a second, if you're married, your husband treats you really well, but you can't have kids. So he says, I'll solve that. We'll just get another one. How that would make you feel. Hannah is a woman, a real person. And so how you can imagine she feels is probably how she felt. Okay? Not great. All right? Verse 3. Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, we'll get to those two characters, two rascals, a little later, okay? They were priests of the Lord. And on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival, that's Peninnah, used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. Now that irritate her is a very aggressive, angry word. It's not like your brother and sister when you were little who just sort of nagged you and irritated you. This is an aggressive, kind of bullying, angry, vindictive type of irritation, okay? She was mean. In other words, so it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? This man's an idiot, by the way. Look what he says. I mean, no more of an idiot than any of us in this room, all right? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? Isn't my love enough, baby? No. It's not. Really not enough, all right? So here's an interesting thing happening here between these two women, okay? Elkanah has invited this trouble into his home, all right? He has. Both women have an identity problem, okay? Hannah is loved by Elkanah, but because she has no children, she is seen as worthless by the world. In that day and age, it's a truly patriarchal society. A woman's only hope for future security was to have male children that would take care of her when she got old. Because one day Elkanah's going to die. The life expectancy of a man at that time was pretty short. And so her hope in her old age to be taken care of is in having children of her own. Because Peninnah's children certainly aren't going to take care of her. They're enemies. Okay? So her whole value as far as the culture is concerned, her only way of taking care of herself, having any kind of influence or say over her future, is in having children. And that's the one thing she can't do. So she's loved by Elkanah, but she doesn't have any way to provide for herself for her future. Peninnah can produce children and has, but she's miserable because her worth is wrapped up in being loved by Elkanah, who does not love her. and is continually expressing his love to his probably first wife, Hannah, instead of her. Both women want what the other woman has. And they're living in the same household. Can you imagine how horrible that must have been? And then poor Elkanah, typical man, hopefully it shouldn't be typical man, but sometimes it is, proposes that he himself is the answer to her problem. He's well-meaning, but frightfully self-centered. He really means well. I mean, he loves her. And guys, I don't know if you ever felt this way before, but to see your wife going through, I mean, this is a depression. She's not eating. I mean, that's a great description of some of the symptoms of depression. And year after year after year, it's being thrown in her face. You can't have kids. You can't have kids. And she's in a depression. And his answer is not to say, look to the Lord. Look to God. God is enough. God will take care of you. God will cover you. God is enough for you. He doesn't point her to him. He doesn't say, God will supply. God will provide. Have you prayed? Doesn't do any of that. He says, baby, all of this is yours. What more could you want in life? Ladies, don't answer. How would you feel in that moment? You would feel horribly misunderstood by the one who's supposed to understand you. And you would feel weirdly criticized, right? Like, clearly, you should just be loving me more, and that would be, right? It's terrible. Hannah's in a horrible spot. This is dark stuff. This is years, it says, year after year after year after year, her being just pummeled by this fear and anxiety and this lack, being confronted by her own, in this case, literal barrenness, and having no way to fix it. And so after this conversation she has with Elkanah, Hannah is even more distressed, right? It's just really true. She's not better. So now she's like, great. I have no identity. My entire identity is wrapped up either in my husband or in not being able to have children. And so understandably, she's weeping and she's so distressed that she looks like she's drunk. I mean, imagine being that upset. Maybe you can. You're so upset and so distraught. You're weeping and she's kind of muttering to herself. Her mouth is moving, but there's no sound coming out. That's how emotional and distressed she is. And so she goes to the temple. She goes to church to pray, right? And she tells God that if he grants her a son, she will make him a Nazarite and a priest. Now, if you don't know what a Nazarite is, let me tell you. At the time, you could not become a priest if you were not a Levite. You were born into that job, okay? As we see, Eli and Hophni and Phinehas, his two sons, were all priests. Hophni and Phinehas were evil. They were wicked. And Eli was sort of wicked in his own way, in kind of a passive way. Okay, God wasn't pleased with any of them. But you couldn't become a priest. So here's a dilemma, right? You have all the Levites, the legitimate priests, are doing a terrible job, but there was another way to become a priest. If someone could dedicate themselves to that job by taking a vow where they'd not cut their hair and they would only eat certain foods and they would separate themselves off and actually live in the temple away from everybody. And sanctify, that's what that means, set apart, set themselves apart, and give up all their inheritance from their family. It would be like changing your last name and saying, I don't have any right to the land my family gives me, the money my family gives me, my children, my parents, everything. I'm completely cut off, and I am moved into a new family, which is the family of God. That's what a Nazarite did. And if you did that, you could become a priest. Right? And so Hannah says to God, if you give me a child, I'll make that vow for him. And I will dedicate him to you as a priest in your temple from a very young age. Thereby relinquishing every right to all the reasons someone would want to have a child in that culture to begin with. Meaning he is not going to be there to take care of me when I'm old. I am not going to give him anything. He doesn't get anything from me, and I don't get anything from him. When I'm old, if this is the only child I have, so be it. I just want a child. Look at verse 12 to 18. As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman. He judged her. And Eli said to her, "How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you." So here's Hannah, already having a hard time. Saying, "We're going to go to the temple and just be in the presence of God and pray." And the head pastor comes walking up and accuses her of being drunk. But Hannah answered, "No, my Lord, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman." Another way to translate that is a good-for-nothing woman. "For all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation." Then Eli answered, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him." And she said, "Let your servant find favor in your eyes." And then the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. That phrase, "good for nothing woman," that is, I think, exactly how everyone saw her. And she had internalized that opinion. This is essentially what Peninnah had been saying to her year after year after year after year. "You're good for nothing. There is nothing good coming out of your life. There is no fruit coming out of your life. You can't even take care of yourself. You are good for nothing. Nothing good comes from you." And it's interesting that a little later, God refers to the sons of Eli using the same word. God calls them good for nothing, but for different reasons. And you get this cool comparison. We'll see that probably next week. So she verbalizes what she feels about herself. And I hope Eli felt bad. He seems to have. And what he does is he blesses her, right? He uses his authority as the priest to bless her prayer and say, "May God hear your prayer." And what does she do? She gets up in joy, right? Her face is no longer sad. This is really important. The order of this is really important. Because she's not pregnant yet. God has not yet answered her prayer. God has not yet given her a child. But she gets up from that prayer, having laid the whole thing at the feet of God, being blessed by the priest. She says, "That's all I can do." And she gets up and her face is no longer sad. And she goes back and it says she eats in just a minute. That's really significant, I think. Because I think what we tend to do, human nature, is to say we pray, and then when God gives us what we want, then we say, "I'm happy." And we make the decision to get up and walk in joy, right? Our joy becomes, and our walk with God and our willingness to move forward in God is dependent on whether or not he gives us what we want, not on just simple, "Here it is, God, do it or don't do it," and lay it at his feet. I think this is the turning point in her story. I don't actually think the turning point in her story was Eli blessing her. I think the turning point in the story was when she got up and went on. So after this, Samuel is born. She gets pregnant. She goes back home. Gets pregnant, and then the big question is she going to follow through? I don't know about you, but it would be hard, I think, when God answers the prayer, especially when we're talking about a child, your only child, your first child, the only child you think you're ever going to have, because I would be assuming that this child is a miracle, and I can't expect more than one miracle, right? So I can finally get the answer to this prayer, and is she going to take Samuel to the temple and do what she said she would do, or is she going to fudge? Is she going to go, well, I'll wait a couple more years when he's a little older. I'll wait a little longer. Maybe God wasn't really paying attention. And you sort of think, maybe I can renegotiate the terms of this deal. I've never been there before. But the reality of it is far different than just saying it. And so the question becomes, is she actually going to go through with this? And she does. She waits until he's weaned, which is not sure when. It could be anywhere from a year to 3 years old, depending on, you know, that was kind of the typical range. Some women would wean their child at one. Some would wait. It doesn't seem like she waited that long, but it's hard to tell how much time passes here. But she does it. In chapter 2, she prays this beautiful worship prayer. I'm going to read it because we're going to see almost the same prayer, interestingly enough, in the New Testament. It says, and Hannah prayed. This is chapter 2, verse 1. And Hannah prayed and said, my heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed, meaning God is just. The bowels of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. So what does she pray and sing? She prays about the justice of God. God is mighty and strong, and he is just. He takes the broken, the barren, the needy, the poor, and he lifts them up. And he takes the strong and the proud, and he lowers them down. Because what has happened to her? That's exactly what's happened to her. She has been under the foot, not just of Peninnah, but of the whole world, being squished down constantly into the dirt and reminded of how barren she is and how good for nothing she is. And what does God do? He comes along and he exalts her. What we're going to see is he doesn't just exalt, he doesn't just give her a child. She gives her probably, you make Moses, Elijah, Samuel, right? One of the most important people in the history of Israel. That's who is born through her. And so she sings a song about justice. You need to understand that when you are mistreated, God is not blind to that. He doesn't ignore it. When you are victimized, he sees it, and he will bring justice. It may be justice later. You don't get to enact justice. Justice is mine, saith the Lord, right? That's what forgiveness is. It's us saying, God, I'm leaving justice in your hands. It's not saying there will be no justice. You're saying I'm putting the need and the desire and the power to get justice in the hands of God. And what does God do with that? Is he unloads every injustice onto the back of Jesus. That's profound, I think. And it's the key to being able to forgive people. It's one thing to forgive somebody who cuts you off in traffic. It's another thing to forgive someone who's really, really hurt you. Inexcusably hurt you. The only way to do that is to do what Hannah did, which is to say all justice belongs to God and he's no wimp. Right? He's not going to go easy on the injustice. He is going to, when all things are said and done and the balances are weighed, they will be even. Every injustice will be paid for, including yours. It's an important part of the nature of God, and it is life to her. It's what comes out of her when she gets pregnant. Look at verse 11. It says, "Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest." This is repeated, that phrase about Samuel, over and over and over again. And in the next chapter, it becomes a comparison with the sons, Hophni and Phinehas. Samuel is ministering to the Lord. That was his job in the temple, to be busy doing things in worship to the Lord. There's an aspect of worship that is just ministering to the Lord, just blessing him. What can I say? What can I do? What can I sing? What can I pray that would bless God? Part of your prayer time is not, it should be dedicated not to asking for stuff from God, but to ministering to him, blessing him, making him happy. God, you're amazing. God, you're glorious. You're wonderful. You're so faithful to me. Look at all the stuff you've done. You look after me. You look after my kids. You take care of me. You take care of the world. You're so powerful, so in control, so loving. And you tell him about him. And that's what Samuel's doing. He is ministering to the Lord. Imagine that was your job. Because it kind of is. All the time. And it's this beautiful picture of this growing, budding relationship and attitude Samuel has about God. And it begins to come through. He's an intense prophet, but there's this dynamic, personal, intimate relationship he has with God that's, I think, unusual to all the other prophets. Is there's this nearness and closeness he has, and we'll see how God speaks to him in just a minute. Let's look at chapter 2. We just read 11. Let's read 18 to 21. This is maybe my favorite part of this section. Samuel was ministering before the Lord. There it is again. A boy clothed with a linen ephod. This is the dress of the priest. Okay, that's what the priest wore. And his mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Isn't that awesome? That's so sweet to me. I don't know how you, all your moms should be going, oh. Think about it for a second. You have taken your son, your only son, and in many ways, your hope for the future, and you have given it to God in a way that cuts off every benefit to you there could be. But you still love him. There's no not loving your child. And so she's been watching Samuel grow up from a distance, going to the temple and worshiping. Maybe she catches a glimpse of him, doing his duties, ministering to the Lord, doing his thing. And she's watching him grow up, and every year, when they go up there to, you know, on the Day of Atonement, she probably weeks ahead of time, she begins to sew him clothes for the year. And each year she has to guess how tall he is and how big he is. She says, oh, look how much he's grown. He's hit a growth spurt. I'm going to have to make this a little longer than last year. And each year, this was like a ritual for her of being reminded every year, year in and year out, that her son was growing up without her at the temple. And she would sew by hand. There's no sewing machines, no Walmart to buy it at. She has to, every stitch she does by her own hand. And I imagine, and I'm a little dramatic, but I imagine her weeping over this thing every year. I mean, wouldn't you? If you were making your child clothes by hand every year and he lived somewhere else from the time he was a little baby, every year I imagine her weeping over as she's sewing this year's holy priestly garments for her son. So you have this mixture of pain and sorrow, but also pride, right? Like a godly kind of pride. Like, look at my boy. Right? Look how he's growing up. He's ministering to the Lord. He's doing the thing that I dreamed he would do in the presence of God all the time. And she's sewing it the best that she can. I just love this little detail in this story. She's still connected to him. She would take it to him each year. That had to have been a cool moment every year. Samuel, come here. Hey, I got you. Here it is. Rub his head. Give him a little kiss. Go, you know. Mom. Oh, Hophni and Phinehas are going to see. Verse 20, then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, may the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord. And so then they would return to their home. In verse 21, indeed the Lord visited Hannah and she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. And the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. So God blessed her. Gave her three boys, two girls. Five kids, six, including Samuel. It's pretty awesome. In our Hope Community Group, we've been reading the book of Luke together, and I was just reading Mary's song, the Magnificat, where the angel comes and tells her, hey, you're gonna conceive a child. This is before she's married. And it's going to be the Messiah. You name him Jesus. Do not be afraid. Poof, he's gone. And she prays this prayer, which is astoundingly similar in wording to this. We should read it. We got time. Let's look in Luke. Sorry, Susan. Luke chapter 1, starting in verse 46. And Mary said, my soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God, my Savior, for he has looked on the humble estate of his servant. For behold, from now on all generations will call me blessed. For he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And his mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of humble estate. He has filled the hungry with food, good things, and the rich he has sent away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham, and to his offspring forever. I wonder if she wasn't actually thinking about Hannah's prayer at the time when she prayed that. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't say. It may just have been the Holy Spirit said the same thing through her as he said to Hannah. If you think about Mary, her reputation was going to be smeared pretty severely. She wasn't married. And I don't know, you know, if you think the Immaculate Conception is a hard one to explain now, it was just as hard then. It would have been way hard for her. Sure. You're miraculously pregnant, even though you're engaged to someone right now. It's a hard one to explain. This wasn't entirely great news to her. It was good news. Messiah's coming. That's crazy. Couldn't you have waited till after we were married? Her reputation was going to get hosed. Yet the true and better king was coming through her. The King of Kings, but not the king of an earthly kingdom, the king of a heavenly kingdom, Jesus, right? Who would usher in his kingdom, right? And all the even the cross was King of Kings. It's crazy. There's a reason for that. He was a king. He was a prophet, capital P prophet. He was a capital K king, right? He's Lord. That's what that means. So I think it's fantastic that Mary is up here in the New Testament and Hannah's back here praying the same thing when God does something miraculous in their womb. Isn't that amazing? The Messiah was prophesied to be a son of David. And Samuel is about to grow up and bring in Saul and then bring in David, who would then, from his line, would come Jesus and fulfill that prophecy. All of that is being set up right here in Hannah's supposedly, quote-unquote, barren womb. This woman who is barren, lost, and just crying out to God for her future. Two women in desperate situations. Two women with no social power, no means to improve their situation, used by God to restore the people of God to God. So the question I want to ask is, what might God do with your barrenness? Think about it. When you look at your need and your lack in life, do you look at it with eyes of faith? I like to say, if you look at your future without God in it, it's always depressing. But if you look at your future with God in it, if you just see God there too, like he's going to be there when I get that to that point in my future, where whatever it is you're worried about, it transforms your whole feeling about how what's going to happen. Even if what happens is bad and hard and terrible, even if tragedy comes, tragedy with God in it is not only survivable, but it can bear fruit in your life. So when you look at your need and your lack, your current lack, your current need, your future need, look with eyes of faith, which is what that means, to look at it and see God in it. And God will then use your lack and your need as a doorway through which he brings redemption. This is what happened to Hannah. She came to God in the temple. She prayed. She laid the whole thing at his feet. And she got up in joy and said, it's with him now. It's with him. I belong to him. He's the king. He's the boss. He's the Lord. I leave it with him. And I walk away in joy, no longer mourning or frustrated. Your barrenness, whatever form of barrenness yours takes, is not a barrier to God's faithfulness. It's not. It might be a barrier to yours. It might be something you can't overcome and you can't get through, but it is not in any way a barrier to God. It's a doorway to God. He looks at your weakness and your need, and he goes, that's just a door through which I'm going to bring redemption. Not just to you. Hannah, yeah, she had kids. She had lots of kids later. But her barrenness was not just about her. It was about the world and the nation of Israel. And not just the nation of Israel. It was about the Messiah who would come later, who would come through King David. So this is where we end this morning, is just like Hannah. Let's lay our burdens down at the feet of Jesus, right? And then rise up in joy. Whatever those things are, whatever your barrenness is, it may be literal, maybe the same as Hannah's. Maybe you want to have kids and you haven't. Or maybe you had kids and you wish they were different. Don't raise your hands. Some of your kids are in the room. I'm half kidding. But whatever that thing is, just imagining God in the middle of it and being like Hannah, like she was weeping and mourning. This is not a fake. Don't be fake and religious and inauthentic about it. Like, go ahead and weep and, like, you know, so much that it's sort of embarrassing, like the ugly cry. Not the cute single tear, like, oh, I'm really moved. I think I'll ask for prayer. Like, to really get in it and tell God how it is and how hard it is. But then there comes a point where you say, okay, I'm laying it here at your feet, and I'm going to get up, and I'm going to keep going, and I'm going to choose joy, as hard as that is. So why don't we stand up together, and I'm going to pray, and then we're going to worship together, and give you a chance to respond further to what God is saying to you. God, everyone in this room has something that they need that they can't supply for themselves. For some of it's a secure future. For some of it's something we need right now. For some of it's a thing in our character that is a weakness that we just haven't been able to overcome. But all of us have things that deep, real, painful needs that we cannot supply for ourselves. God, I pray that you would protect us from the bitterness that could have set in for Hannah, but didn't. God, protect us from that same threat of bitterness, that we would not grow bitter like Peninnah did, but you would protect us from that and help us right now with eyes of faith to lay our need, our barrenness, our weakness, or our fear over the future, whatever it is, God, that we lay that down at your feet, to pour it out like in a real way, not in some kind of fake Christian-y way that's not real, but God, that you would help us to pour those things out, to face those things, to face injustices, to face need, and to really understand it, but at the same time, give it to you and say, God, here it is. Here's what I need. And I pray that by your Spirit, you would enable us to have the faith to rise up from that and move on in joy. God, that you would step through the door of our brokenness to bring redemption not only to us, but to the world. This is what we ask you for right now. In the name of Jesus. Amen.